I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Tribune News Mark Greenwood.
Welcome. Hello. Mark. Thank you very much.
Mark, I've been really looking forward to meeting you, particularly because I have a great interest in history.
We share it.
And you go by this wonderful tag, the History Hunter. isn't it beautiful? And not only that, but you write particularly for young adults. And I want to talk a bit more about that, but Fremantle Press publish you. There's a whole lot of new ones out from last year and this year. The Vanishing, The Dragon's Treasure, The Deadly Diamond, The Wonder Horse. Just tell me a little bit about yourself. Where did your interest in history come from, and how did you get into writing this stuff?
Well, I tour a lot and I talk to a lot of school kids, and a while ago they wanted to sort of give me a bit of a brand, which was where the History Hunter came from. But the books that you just introduced then are what we call sort of books for older readers. So we're talking about upper primary, early secondary. But I've also done a lot of history books in picture book format. And I guess my real interest in history and where it came from was the first book that I did, which was on the famous legend of Moondyne Joe. And so that incredible character, and I'm a local and he was a local, and the prison there and being around, and just kind of getting a real interest in deep diving into the history of a person, a character, and their journey and their quest and their challenges and all those sort of things. And sometimes researching history gives you a really great appreciation of your own place, and particularly, being that I live in Fremantle, researching the story of Moondyne Joe just kind of really brought home that convict history that we have, which I guess was once a bit of a birth stain, wasn't it? Now it's something to celebrate. So that was the first, Moondyne Joe was the first sort of character that I got really, really interested in, and it's just grown from there. And I've done, books on the legend of Lassiter's Reef, and of course, the more iconic figures in history like Ned Kelly in picture book format. But there used to be an ad on TV years ago for a non-alcoholic drink called Clayton's, and it had a great slogan. It was the drink you're having when you're not having a drink. So my aim with going and visiting kids in schools is that it's storytelling, and it's told through stories. History told through stories, I reckon, will never be forgotten. That's what Rudyard Kipling said. So mine is the history you're having when you're not having history.
Well, I love it. And what I've also discovered as I've got older, perhaps you learn this when you're younger as an adult and you've suddenly got kids, and I'm reading to my son and my daughter, and then later my granddaughters, making up my own stories, is that it doesn't matter how... For who the intended readership is, how young they're meant to be, and adult can read it and enjoy it.
I look at my books, and I actually have a lot of time, even with the picture books. It's a weird thing with, especially writing for young people, is that, and particularly in picture book format, is it's a strange kind of format, because the people who buy the books are the parents, and they buy it because they want their children to enjoy it, but ultimately they end up reading it a lot anyway. So I think those sort of books have got to be something that appeals to both audiences. So it appeals to the audience, the adult audience, and it also appeals to the child reader. So, history's for everyone, isn't it?
Well, just to not test the theory, but to make the point, because certainly when I look through the topics of the books you've written and the ones I mentioned earlier, it comes right out. So briefly tell our listeners what the Vanishing topic is.
The Vanishing is, when we think of history, we kind of think of those convicts and the bushrangers and all that, but the Vanishing is really different. It is history, but it's a sort of a paranormal history, really. It's a story of a fellow called Frederick Valentich, who was flying a little Cessna over the Bass Strait in October 1978. Had a very interesting conversation, which was recorded with Melbourne Flight Control, where he was reporting that there was an aircraft that eventually he said wasn't an aircraft, and he vanished and was never seen again. And so the story of The Vanishing, all these books are presenting a case in history and then presenting all the options of what could have happened, what may have happened. And so a lot of them, particularly this one, The Vanishing, was never solved. We never ever found out what happened to Frederick Valentich. And interestingly enough, about 3 weeks ago, another couple flying their small plane over the Bass Strait vanished as well. So, and it has had a little bit of a reputation, the Bass Strait, if you believe in all those sort of things. So it's a way that young people can delve into history and then look at options and perspectives and sort of, in some respects, come up with their own conclusions. To
Well, I can see that immediately appealed to me. I can see a parent would see that and say, well, that's interesting. I'm sure Tommy or Jody will love that. Mm. And on that topic, I mean, what's an ideal age, or is there no such thing, for reading these books? And what about the gender balance?
Well, I think that I have been doing for a long time lots and lots of school visits nationally, and because of the picture books, I was often working with the younger audiences and visiting and talking to them about my books. And then gradually over the years, what's happened is I've been more and more invited to speak to high school age students. And it's not so much because of the content, it's all about the research, the process, the creative process. So that's something. And so after a while I thought, well, I would really like to do a kind of a book that would appeal to that reader as well, which was kind of the basic idea behind the History Hunter series, was that it would be for older readers, but it could also be enjoyed by younger kids too, especially, I really like appealing to reluctant readers. I really like the books that will appeal to kids who, you know, can't find something that they really like, and often it's just because they haven't found a book that appeals to them. So that's one of the things that I'm keen to sort of tap into as well. But yeah, I think that history is for everyone. I don't really think that it has, like we were saying before, I don't think it really has an age. It's whether you're a school age, or whether you're a parent, or whether you're a grandparent, history is really can be really exciting.
Well, I remember Arthur Fiedler, who conducted the Boston Orchestra years ago, brought out a fabulous album that I think I've still got, an LP. Right. This is classical music for people who don't like classical music.
Perfect.
It's the same sort of thing.
There you go, yeah.
Do you have to put yourself into the mind, let's say, of a 13 or 14-year-old when you are writing and expressing yourself? Or is it a matter of taking out all the adjectives and adverbs and keeping it simple, or putting the adjectives and adverbs in because it makes it lively?
Mm. Well, interesting question. I think that there was a fellow who's written a book on creativity recently. He's a fellow called Rick Rubin, and he's a record producer. He's produced many, many people over the years, and one of his philosophies is that you don't write for the audience when you're writing. You find a subject that you care about, that you think is really riveting, that you can spend a lot of time with the character, because the books don't, you know, develop overnight. They take a long time. So I always like to find a character that appeals to me, that's got something a little bit different that makes them stand out from others, so I know that spending a lot of time with them is going to be of interest to me. I always say find a subject that you care about, and that's basically what my philosophy has been with these things, because I have to do a huge deep dive, and sometimes then when you start the writing process, these books have got a little bit of a kind of a, they're a series, so they've got a similar design concept, in the fact of, you know, the introductions and the chapters and the more to explore pages and all those things. So there is a little bit of a, not a formula, but there is a bit of a design. So the first one was probably the hardest, and then having that sort of template, didn't make it easier, but just made it a little bit more that I knew what I was doing as the series has progressed.
I should interpolate here to go back to your reference to the picture books and say that I think I did a podcast some time ago with someone you know well, Fano Lissac, who illustrates some of your books.
Yes, she does. Yeah, that's right. We've done a number of books, pretty much all history books together. We both love traveling, if we can, to the places where stories have happened. So we've been to, you know, Gallipoli to put together the book on Simpson and his donkey, and to Beersheba when we did a story about the light horse. So we really love doing that. And one of the things that we've found in visiting schools is that a lot of kids go, oh, you're so lucky, you get to go to all these places. So a while ago we did a book for them, which would take young people on imaginary journeys to places. So we called it Where History Happened. So there were places in around the nation where historical events have happened, where, you know, maybe one day those kids will be travelling with their parents and go, wow, we're here, you know, where it actually all happened. And they know that then what that feeling is like.
Oh, it's so real. I was recently in Turkey, basically after Istanbul started in Gallipoli. And then along the coast, and you're in Troy, you're in Ephesus.
You don't have to go very far from Gallipoli to find some other incredible history, do you?
It's just amazing, and it was exactly your reaction, because I hadn't been there. You say, I'm here at last, and you're living human history as well as the natural history of the planet.
There's nothing better. I mean, there's nothing better than to actually have that appreciation. You're in a place where historical events happen. But, you know, like, it's happened all around us. You know, we live in here in Fremantle. There are these incredible historical events happen. No matter what street you walk up and down in Fremantle, something amazing's happened there over the years. And so if you kind of get a little sense of where you are and an appreciation of that, then I think that your whole place becomes a living, breathing, a piece of history that you can love and enjoy, you know.
Just to complete the quick description of the four History Hunted books that I've referred to, I don't think I have to guess very hard to know what The Dragon's Treasure is about, but quickly, in a sentence, tell our listeners.
I've always been interested in the Dutch shipwreck history of our coast, which is sort of well known here, but over in the eastern states, not so well known. And so the story of the Gilt Dragon was always a classic. It happened not far from Fremantle, and one of the, you know, the stories that come from that shipwreck was that, you know, the rumour that some of the treasure was managed to, you know, had been salvaged by some of the survivors who did exist and live on our shoreline for a long time and then vanished into history as well. Incredible story. But the fact that in 1931 a group of kids was, you know, chasing a fox along the coast in West Australia and just up from seabird stumbled across literally a real treasure, coins and silver ingots and all sorts of things that potentially probably belonged to one of the survivors of that shipwreck who managed to get onto the mainland. And then, and you know, it's like when you leave a burning plane and everyone says, leave your overhead baggage there. But this person's obviously thought, oh, I'm going to bring my private treasures with me, and finally got to the coast and realised that private treasures on this barren part of, you know, this southern continent were really no value at all, and left them there. And in 1931, these kids found them. It's just an incredible, you know, history that's not so old. And the findings that those kids made in 1931 sort of confirmed that there was a ship close by, and so sort of led to the discovery of that shipwreck.
Well, you'd be interested to know another story, a footnote. I once had the job of sitting there and counting the coins off the wreck.
Wow, amazing.
But that is another story.
Yeah, that's an amazing, yeah.
No diamonds there, but the deadly diamond, the next book in this series, everyone gets fascinated by this diamond. Yeah. Tell us about it.
Well, some stories linger around in the memory or the creative subconscious, waiting for the right moment to come along. I always wanted to do a story. I'm fascinated by it. Outside of writing, my hobby was rocks and gems and geology and meteorites and all sorts of things. And I always thought that this was my hobby outside of writing, my escape from writing. But somehow those things tend to infiltrate. And eventually, you know, rocks and minerals and everything, you get to the top of the tree and you get to diamonds. And I became pretty interested in diamonds and then realised that pretty much all the great diamonds of the world, the most famous diamonds of the world, had all come from one place in India called Golconda. And they were mined there in the 1600s and the Koh-i-Noor, you know, in the British crown jewels. And so the Hope diamond, the big, large blue diamond, which is in the Smithsonian Museum in Washington, has an incredible history. it's travelled through all those eras. It's passed, you know, through kings and through commoners, and it's been recut, it's been resized, it's been reshaped, it's been tried to be disguised. But the interesting thing was that the supposed curse associated with it. And the books aren't just about stories about the history, but it's also about can an object, you know, have that, is it possible that that sort of strange thing can happen to an object, and is it possible? And it's really not just telling about the supposed curse, but it's also tracking this diamond's movements across the world. You know, it went from India, it went to France, to all the three kings in France. It was stolen during the French Revolution, went over to England, was recut there to disguise that it was, you know, belonged to a French king so that there wouldn't be a war between England and Germany, and then made its way to America, and eventually, yeah, Pierre Cartier had it at one point. Sold it to a rich socialite over in America, and everyone who seemed to have some association with this diamond had some misfortune happen to them, and that misfortune was always, you know, put on, this is what happens when you go near this big blue diamond.
Well, let's hope it doesn't get cancelled in the Smithsonian.
Well, it's behind 3-inch bulletproof glass there, and laser beams at night time, and all sorts of things. It's well protected in the Smithsonian.
The one thing you wouldn't want to do is put it in a light plane and fly across Bass Strait with it.
No, definitely not. No, Frederick Valentich didn't have a blue diamond on him, I'm pretty sure, but who knows.
The Wonder Horse, the latest, that will be of interest to a lot of people.
Yeah, no, the Wonder Horse is, occasionally these stories come along that just give your heart a big hug, and the story of Farlap is absolutely like that for me. I probably, you know, when you do write and research about history, there are stories that come along, and once you start getting involved in them, they never leave you. And, you know, Moondyne Joe will never leave me, neither will Harold Lasseter, but the story of Farlap was just an extraordinary story, and I loved every moment of writing it. And that's one of those books that when you finish it, you just wish it didn't ever finish, because I loved it so much. Most importantly, most people know the great horse and all the incredible achievements that he did here in Australia. I mean, winning the Melbourne Cup in 1930 and virtually every other race. And so, when you start to watch his racing and see it progress, he was winning by the photos that exist. He was winning by margins that you can't even see the other horses in the photographs. And he was a beautiful, big chestnut horse. But the most important thing for me was that I'm an animal lover. I've always had dogs. And there is a mystical bond that happens between animals and humans. And it's a hard thing to describe unless you do have that love of animals. And Farlap and his association with the young strapper, Tommy Woodcock, who eventually became his trainer, it was an extraordinary bond, a human-animal bond, to the point where at one point Tommy didn't like the way that a Farlap as a young horse was being trained. He didn't like it being trained with cruelty. They tried to really work that horse hard because at first it was a pretty gangly, awkward-looking thing that didn't really look much like a racehorse. And so Harry Telford, the trainer, really, really gave it a hard time. Tommy didn't like that, and at one point he left. He quit and he left. And about a week later, Harry Telford said, "Can you please come back? Because the horse won't eat without you being there.
Amazing.
And it won't sleep. And it's not itself." So Tommy was the one who said virtually that the horse will respond to kindness. So, and it did. And we've got this, you know, huge, big horse, you know, that was such an incredible sports figure that eventually loved children, loved having children on its back, was a very gentle giant, and you know, such an icon of Australian history. And then eventually, when the gangsters didn't like the fact that a horse that couldn't be beaten was not much point having for them, there was an assassination attempt. And just recently I was over in Melbourne and, you know, I went to Etna Street in Melbourne near the Caulfield Racecourse. And, you know, I'm just looking there and I know this is the place where the assassination attempt on Farlap happened. And there's a lady walking along the street and I said, do you live here? And she said, yeah. And I told her the story. She says, wow, you know, I had no idea. So, again, where history happened in this little suburban street.
And it's those bits of history, isn't it? And, of course, a big heart, this horse.
Well, be careful of the big heart story, and I don't want to burst anyone's bubble, but Farlap eventually had so much weight put on him, and the assassination attempts, and people were going to throw poison in his eyes, and all sorts of terrible things. Eventually, Tommy Woodcock and Harry Telford decided that there was a race over in America. Dave Davis, the owner, there was a race over in America, in Mexico. And it was the richest horse race in the world. And if they could get him over there, he would probably be the greatest racehorse in the world. So he left Australia and very sadly, because he was an icon for everyone, loved by everyone here, an absolute hero, especially in those dark days of the Depression when no one really had any reason for joy or hope. He was the one that gave everybody a bit of hope because they needed something to look up to, something that was brightened their day. And Farlap was that horse, went over to America. About 3 weeks before the race on the stony race courses in Mexico, he cracked his hoof. And they decided that the only way that that horse would ever run the race would be to cut a third of the hoof off. And for about 2 weeks before the race, Tommy just bathed it in iodine for about five times a day to try and harden it up. And eventually he was pretty much on three legs when he raced and won the race. Incredible. It was everybody who saw it said they'd just seen something that they would never ever see again in their lifetime. And 16 days later he was mysteriously dead, and it's always been the mystery of what happened to Farlap. And my understanding, and I've presented a lot of options in the book so that people can again look at all the different things, possibilities. One of the possibilities was that Farlap, they'd done some testing on the mane hairs, which is in the effigy in the Melbourne Museum, and they say that 30 to 40 hours before Farlap's death, he ingested a massive dose of arsenic. So it's where the arsenic came from. When he presented sick, the horse doctor, Bill Nielsen, Tommy was distraught. Bill Nielsen had just come home from being out really late at the speakeasies in Mexico, where in America, where, you know, alcohol was at prohibition at that time, and they made a big horse capsule, and in those days, arsenic was one of the ingredients for horse tonics, and there's always Tommy never spoke about it, but towards the end of his life, just before the end of his life, he said, "I think I know what happened, and I think that accidentally there was too much arsenic mixed in the tonic." Now, Bill Nielsen, I think, sobered up. I'm not putting anything on him, because I think he sobered up and realised what he'd done, because immediately when they did the autopsy on Farlap, it was done very quickly, all the main organs were removed, they were put in a metal box and they were buried and they've never been found, including the heart. So the heart that's in the Canberra Museum potentially is not Farlap's heart, which destroys the whole beautiful, as hard as big as Farlap's, destroys that terrific sort of slogan that we have here in Australia. But truth is always important too, isn't it?
But when you tell that whole story, it adds to the mystery.
It does add to the mystery, and they've tried to find the metal box containing all the interestingly. A little side story. Recently I was travelling and I came back through San Francisco and I realised I was probably only about 2 hours away from Menlo Park, which was the ranch that Farlap was housed at where he died. And I got in touch with a lady from the Historical Society in Atherton who loves Farlap. They have a big Farlap day there. They absolutely adore that horse still. And she said, "I'll take you somewhere." She said, "I don't want you to be upset." And I said, "No, it's all right." So I followed her down the side of Menlo Park College. And at the back of the college, I saw a skip and, there was a storerooms and that. And I looked carefully and I started to think, hang on a minute, this looks like a stable. And the back of the Menlo Park College is a storeroom, but it's actually the stables where Farlap was housed. And it's a bit destroying to see, you know, our great, this is where he, and not really looked after.
Yeah.
But interestingly, the lady said to me, you're only the second person who's come here, you know, to visit this place. And I said, oh, yeah. And she said, the other person that came here was Bob Hawke.
Oh, for goodness sake.
Yeah, she said he loved horses. He was a horse racing man and he was in America and he just wanted to come and pay his respects at the place where Farlap passed away. So,
well, Mark, I love what you're doing with all of this. I mean, you're retelling some of these stories, but you're telling them with verve. You've got a certain readership in mind, and I have a funny feeling it probably enlivens the history. You're not writing for people who you might think are learned and you have to address them in a particular way. You're writing people for whom this is all fresh.
Yeah.
And you want to make sure you get to them.
Yep.
And I think you are.
Well, with Farlap, one of the things in the book, somewhere in the book, I think I mentioned that the idea is for readers think that we're still cheering this horse on. You know, 100 odd years later, we're still cheering him on in that... And it's the same with Dead Kelly. Every time we, you know, discuss whether he was a hero or a villain, we're symbolically giving him a retrial, aren't we? You know, we're all, whether he deserves forgiveness or not. So this is the great thing about history. It lives and breathes. It doesn't go away. It just becomes more interesting. And I'm usually the last curious person on a long range of curious people who've come before me. And I am always grateful because they are writing and I'm using their writing to then figure out my own way of telling a well-known story, but maybe looking at it from a new different way. I mean, with Ned Kelly, he rescued a young boy on the way to school and he was given a green silk sash by the young boy's father, and Ned treasured this sash and he was wearing it under his armour at Glen Rowan when he was finally captured. And it was a symbol of courage. So to me, it was like a window into his life, but it was a little known part of the Ned Kelly story. So I'm always like that, because there's so many stories. And
finding these things I mean, history tells you about life. It's not as if it's dead and dried and thrown away. It really helps to study our own way of living here and now.
Absolutely, and even with the story of Farlap, nothing to do with horse racing. It's nothing to do with gambling or anything like that. It's a human story, which is what history is all about, isn't it? They're all human stories.
Mark, you obviously got a great interest and love of what you do. Your curiosity must be constantly at play. I guess it is. You're walking down the street and you probably see something and think, oh, I wonder if we might write the next book about such and such a topic. How do they come to you, these topics?
I sometimes think that stories find me in a way. Not to reference one of those crazy rock bands like the Rolling Stones, but someone did ask Keith Richards, the guitar player, many years ago in an interview, and I read it and I thought it was a great thing. They asked him where he got his ideas from for his great songs that he's written. And he said, ideas are everywhere. He said, but, you know, he said, remember that old transistor radio with the aerial that you put up? He said, without the aerial up, you won't be able to tune into the station. So he said, you've got to have that imaginary idea antenna up. And if you do, look out, because the ideas will come thick and fast. So I think that I do have that antenna up, and ideas do come. And sometimes, like I say, with the Deadly Diamond, they brood around. That story's been with me for almost 20 years. And I've been to India 3 times researching it and having a great time doing, you know, following in the footsteps of the merchant who brought it back in 1600s. But so they just have a way of sort of entering into your creative subconscious, and then when is the time right for it to come out in a book form? And it's really hard to know where ideas come from. They just sort of, you know, they most people who are painters or, you know, musicians or anything, there's just some spark. It's a spark of some sort that, and that once it grabs you, then it's very difficult to get it out of your mind.
Well, Mark Greenwood, it's been lovely talking to you. May the sparks keep sparking. Yeah. May the antenna be held high.
Thank you.
And may all of these ideas keep percolating through your brain and coming out in the History Hunter books. It's just wonderful.
Thank you. We've got a couple more coming out next year, and one I've just been on some fantastic research for is the story of Captain Kidd, the unlucky pirate, who went out as a privateer for the King of England, and his job was to hunt pirates and to seize their treasure and to, they had a great concept where all these investors were going to share the money, and something not quite went right for Captain Kidd, so that's one coming up for next year. So,
thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
Lovely meeting you.
Thank you very much.